Opening the show was a little snippet from Choose Love by Laura Kane. So thank you, Laura. And tonight, I believe we have another excellent show for you. At the top of the hour is author Marie Jones, and we'll be discussing her book, The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three and the Code of Creation. We'll get into the Trinity concept and that was around before Christianity, I would imagine. We'll look at the triune nature of creation and chat about why the number three shows up so much in folklore, fairy tales, and myth. And we'll delve into if there's evidence of the number three, the Trinity, in ancient wisdom teachings, and of course, why do we care? We'll talk about if we can use the secret of three to make our lives much more fulfilling. Then in the second half of the show, we're very lucky to have with us Yaba Bado. She's a producer and director of the award-winning film The Witches of Gumbaga. She's here in the United States for numerous screenings across the country, and we're fortunate to catch her while she's in the States. Witches of Gumbaga is the extraordinary story of a community of women condemned to live as witches in northern Ghana. Their tale is a sad one, one where their very fate, their lives can be determined by how a chicken dies. Wow. Well, before we get to our guests, I have a promise to keep. As I promised, in honor of Keith Olbermann of Countdown fame from MSNBC, who we know will be back June 20th as not just the news director on Al Gore's current TV, but he's going to be bringing back Countdown. I'll ask the question he would have asked every night since he's been off the air. Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters to get elected, but you've really pulled a bait and switch, haven't you, Mr. Boehner? All you and the Republicans seem to be doing is working on redefining rape, trying to take the rights of women to their bodies away from them. All the grand old plutocracy seems to be doing is using the deficit crisis to thwart democracy as your radical Republican governors dissolve towns, neutralize elected officials, and cancel contracts. Well, we see you, Mr. Boehner. We see what you're up to. You aren't able to hide what your party is about or who it serves. We know you want to privatize Medicare and food stamps, making more parasitic CEOs, but where is your moral justification? Maybe it's because of your heroine, Ayn Rand, who believes the only people of value are those at the top and the rest of us are the real parasites in your eyes. You must be very certain, Mr. Boehner, you're rich enough and your cronies are rich enough that you will never need the social safety net. But what about women? 70% already retire in poverty. Millions of children today in the United States go to bed hungry, and you want to cut more from them while you give your corporate welfare queens even more tax breaks. What would Jesus say about this Rand-inspired selfishness, Mr. Boehner? Maybe you and the Republican governor should just pass a law now and get it over with. You can just call it Republicans for Soylent Green. We know who have their hands on our throats, Mr. Boehner, and it's not the Democrats. So, that's my rant for tonight. That'll have to serve for my What's the Buzz segment. But new developments I want to tell you about. First of all, In June, I hope if you're in the area, you will join me for a retreat where I'm one of the presenters. Gaia's Womb is sponsoring the retreat called The Sacred Feminine, Changing the Paradigm. I'll be there all weekend participating, but my formal presentation is Saturday, the first weekend in June, when I'm presenting Living the Sacred Feminine Lifestyle from Patriarchy to Partnership. Gaia's Womb is in their 13th year, and they're calling forth the woman tribe to gather at the Gateway to Summer for a very special weekend retreat. Join us all as we bring together women from all parts of the United States. My co-presenter is Judika Isles, and we're going to have a wonderful weekend. If you want more information about that, just go to gaiaswomb.com and go to the events page. It's going to be a journey of exploration from the hallowed halls of goddess temples of ancient past and forward, perhaps to glimpse the hallowed halls of governance of nations of the world of the future, a future in which the sacred feminine rises once again to partner with men and to facilitate the peaceful healing of our world. So, as I said, join us. Empower yourself, learn how to become her sacred roar. And please remember, or maybe it's the first time you've heard, Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. This last year, I've actually had to pay for the airtime, and I would appreciate it if listeners out there would, help with that, if they like what I present each week. Because remember, as Goddess teaches us, what we tend to, what we nurture, what we nourish, well, it thrives, and what we neglect withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations and contributions to keep the show on the air. And if you'd like to do that, you can go to my website at KarenTate.com, go to the Goddess Store button or page. The button will take you to the page, and there are PayPal buttons there where you can make a contribution of any amount you can afford. And while you're looking at my show page on your computer screen, look around and you will see the three F's. One is favorite, one is friend, and one is follow. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Also, be sure to become our friend. And maybe the most important of the three F's is follow. If you click the follow button, you will never miss notice of my new guests each week. That way you're a part of our growing family of listeners. And if you don't get an email reminder from me personally, you will get one directly from Blog Talk. All right. Well, for now, I think I'm going to skip the rest, and I'm going to just go ahead and start turning our attention to tonight's show. You know, many of you have emailed me saying how much you like the show's motto, and I think for our guest tonight, it's really appropriate, so I'll just mention it real quick before we get started with our first interview. This is a quote from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. It goes like this: all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. Well, you know, we share so many new ideas and concepts on the show here that I think that's really appropriate. And, you know, sometimes these ideas at some point in their life, might sound just way out there and ridiculous. And then before you know it, not that much time passes, and we look around and we aren't ourselves just accepting new ideas as truth and fact, but society is too. And no doubt that will sort of fall in line, I believe, with what our first guest, Marie Jones, has to talk to us about. Let me tell you a little bit about her before we start our chat. Marie Jones is the best-selling author of the popular and highly regarded book, PSI, Science, How New Discoveries in Quantum Physics and New Science May Explain the Existence of Paranormal Phenomena. She's also the author of 2013, End of Days or A New Beginning, Envisioning the World After the Events of 2012. She's the co-author of a book she wrote with her father, a geophysicist, called Super Volcano, The Catastrophic Event That Changed the Course course of human history. She's also the author or co-author of 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomena, The Meaning Behind Mysterious Signs, Sequences, and Synchronicities, and The Resonance Key, Exploring the Links Between Vibration, Consciousness, and the Zero Point Grid. I believe she wrote that with Larry Flaxman, her partner in Para Explorers. Well, as I said at the top of the show, tonight we're going to specifically talk about her book, The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three and the Code of Creation. But if we have some time, those titles really pique my curiosity, so maybe we'll ask a few questions about some of her other books. Marie, she has an extensive background in new science, metaphysics, and the paranormal. She's worked as a field investigator for MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, in L.A. and San Diego. She serves as a director of special projects for the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies team. She's co-authored over 50 inspirational books for Publications International, and she's also a screenwriter with several projects currently in development. She's appeared on television, History Channel's Nostradamus Effect, 30-odd minutes, and she's been on hundreds of radio shows, including ones I'm sure you'll recognize, X-Zone, Coast to Coast, NPR, Shirley MacLaine Show, and she's been interviewed in dozens of newspapers, magazines, and online publications. She lives in San Marcos, California, and we are certainly glad to have her here on the show tonight. So, Marie, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess let's start at the beginning, the Trinity Secret. I think when people hear Trinity, maybe their minds automatically go to Christianity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost.
Right.
Is that where your mind goes? And I guess what inspired you to write the book?
Well, I have to start a few years ago. I had just decided to partner with Larry Flaxman, who I do a lot of projects, write a lot of books with. And for our first book, we wrote 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomenon. And the book was really about the profound and magical nature of numbers and mathematics. And throughout the book, we kept running into the number three. It's everywhere. It's in every religion, every mythology, creation stories, science, the structure of the human brain, the levels of consciousness, everywhere. And we said to ourselves, let's revisit this later. We went on and wrote a couple of other books. So when the time came to do something new, we pulled that back out. And many, many years ago, I had written a dissertation paper for a ministerial school on Trinity symbolism. And I'd always wanted to do something with that for publication. We weren't allowed
to
publish.
I'm sorry, say again, what kind of symbolism?
Trinity.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
So I wrote this.
I thought I heard something else. Okay, go ahead.
No, I wrote this really formal paper, you know, about Trinity symbolism, but it wasn't publishable in terms of being marketable. So I got the opportunity to take that research, and Larry and I did a lot of new research, and we found links even to all of the law of attraction teachings, which are so popular today. It really kind of blew our minds to see just how profound the number three is and why.
Well, so I would imagine, I mean, you're coming at this as a scientist as opposed to a theologian, correct?
Well, yes, but also as a metaphysician, because I've been metaphysics is my background. But yes, absolutely. Everything that I write, everything that Larry and I write, we try to look at the scientific side and the metaphysical / spiritual side and look for links and ways that these two sides come together. And what's so surprising is that it happens so much more than people think. When
right.
you have science and metaphysics talking about the same concepts, they're just using different language. And
right,
that's where
right.
we get stuck with the language.
Right, right. We think we're really on opposite sides, but we're probably closer in understanding than we think if we just had a common understanding and language that we're on the same page. Well, okay, so most of us recognize the Trinity from Christianity. I know probably a lot of my listeners are into paganism and ancient cultures, so they probably know there have been trinities long before Christianity. But
right.
why don't you go ahead and talk about the Trinity concept in other religions or belief systems? So let's start there.
Well, you know, there were Trinity concepts as far back as 3000 BC with Hermeticism. Hermes talked a lot about this triadic nature of reality, and that was way before Christianity was developed, and a lot of people, a lot of scholars do believe that Christianity has a lot of Hermetic influence. But he had his own Trinity as well, and it was very similar. We had a God figure, Atum. He had the cosmos, which was creation, and then he had humans, which were the sort of third wheel. But then again, moving up a little more currently, we see it in a lot of Native American traditions, a lot of indigenous tribal traditions. We see it in ancient Greek, ancient Egyptian, ancient Roman, Norse. It's everywhere. So it's not something that Christianity or Catholicism mainly just came up with.
They came up with themselves. Yeah, they've you know, just like the Jews borrowed from the Babylonians, they borrowed an awful lot from the pagans.
Right, and even the Sumerians, as far back as the Sumerians, they looked at the creation of the world as being a triadic, as having three different levels. And this was something that we found in all the creation myths that we looked in, all the cosmogenesis stories of different cultures and civilizations. And paganism, of course, is rampant with triads. So this is older stuff.
And adds
a lot of symbols, you know, and a lot of concepts and rituals that began long before Christianity or the Western traditional religions. They seem to borrow from them. And what happens is they take the symbolism and then they sort of wipe out or attempt to wipe out the pagan origins.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what happened with the Trinity.
So, I was just, when you said they wiped out the idea of the Trinity, it made me think, well, they also tried to wipe out the idea of goddess, too. Sorry, my mind sort of banged up against the wall there. So the idea of the Trinity, you know, we see it over and over again in terms of like creator gods and goddesses. And, you know, from origin myths all over the world. But what, you know, but where does mythology and science sort of meet in terms of the, I guess what you call it, the triune nature of reality?
Right. And I do want to say that, you know, there's no mention of the Trinity in the Old Testament, but when Christianity was born, they understood this concept, but they didn't quite know how to explain it properly. So we do know that some of the philosophers and teachers and spiritual leaders that were working on creating Christianity, if you want to say that, they knew of the Trinity. What they were trying to do, though, was describe it to people in a way that it could be understood, and they have failed miserably at that. To this day, there is discussion and debate and argument over, you know, what does the Trinity mean, and there's a reason for that, and that is because they were focusing on it as being a description of the persona of God. And what Larry and I found looking at different mythologies, creation myths, even heroes' journeys, you know, the Joseph Campbell believed that there was a Trinity in the hero's journey, and he thought Star Wars was such a wonderful example of that. We really believe that the Trinity is describing not a persona, but a process.
Okay.
And as soon as the process of creation, basically, and as soon as we took on that angle, all of these stories from every religion, from different mythologies, from paganism, they all began to make sense.
So, in other words, the difference is when we have it in the religious sphere, it's about deities and trying to personify creation. When we're looking at it from the scientific angle, it's more of a process.
A process. And there's been so much confusion in the Catholic Church. I mean, I grew up Catholic, and I remember if this is a description of the persona of God, then is the Father equal to the Son? Does the Son exist apart from the Father? What is the Holy Spirit? It's as if this argument continues to this day when you look at it in that way. If you look at the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit as a process of creation, it makes total sense. and then you begin to see it everywhere else.
Okay.
What science steps in is that David Bohm, my favorite physicist, he's a wonderful physicist who was very much involved in quantum theory and the birth and rise of quantum physics, if you'd like to say that. And he had a belief that reality has a triune nature. And it matches perfectly with our Trinity secret, which really is just a modern description of this creative process that's been around forever.
All right. So you're going to explain that to us then.
I will.
okay.
I'll start with the process itself, and then I'll explain the science part of it, because I think it's a little more understandable that way. What we found in looking at all of these myths and stories and even folklore and fairy tales and the development of human language is that there is a three-part process to create something out of either allness or nothing, whatever you want to call it. Now, those three parts consist of a creator, creation, and an act of creating. That's it. It is that simple. So when you look at the Trinity, the Catholic version of the Trinity, you have a Father, you have a God aspect. That is the Creator. You have the Son. Jesus Christ was called many times God manifested on earth, physical manifestation. And you have the act of creation itself, which is the Holy Spirit. And all throughout the New Testament, we hear that the Holy Spirit was like the breath of God, the life-giving breath that was breathed into people and brought people grace.
Mm-hmm.
So what we began to look at is, okay, is there any evidence of this three-part process anywhere else in science, you know, in our DNA? And quantum physics, of course, is one of the most amazing fields of study, because what it seems to be happening is that we are discovering that what happens at the quantum level also may be applicable at the more cosmic level. And again, going back to David Bohm, physicist, very much involved in quantum physics, he believed that there were three levels of creation or reality, three orders, he called them. There was a super implicate order, which was a sort of godly overseeing order, the source, if you want to call it that. There was an explicate order, which was manifest physical reality. That would be the sun aspect of the Trinity. The most important was the implicate, the one in the middle. The implicate order was an invisible level of connectivity where everything was connected to everything else. This is where something was taken out of the higher super implicate order and moved and made manifest in the explicate. So the implicate order is where all the activity took place.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you look at the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Holy Spirit aspect has been the one thing that a lot of Christians and Catholics especially have had a really tough time trying to figure out, well, what is it?
Right,
it's the breath of life. It's the activating agent. It's even been referred to as the yeast of life, because if you have flour and water, you're not going to be able to make bread until you get the dough to rise, and the yeast is that activating agent.
Would it also, in some traditions, be considered the Shakti?
You know, we didn't even look into that. What is the Shakti?
Well, that's like the, in goddess circles, feminine face of God sort of the realms, that's sort of like the life force,
Well,
it's,
again, there were many names for that. Chi energy. Well, what's interesting is there actually was a female trinity in the very early years of Christianity where Sophia, the goddess of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
took the place of the father aspect, but that got wiped out pretty quick.
Right. Well, the whole idea of Sophia, people who listen to my show will know that, a lot of the ancient texts that got translated, the pronouns she got changed to he.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, it's once you're talking to this crowd, they easily, take the Holy Spirit to mean Sophia.
Well, and wisdom, understanding, but also, again, if we're going back to, as you said, the Shakti, the chi, life energy. Without
mm-hmm.
that, we are inanimate.
Right.
So you
right.
can have a creator. You can, you know, the idea is to get something created in the physical world, to manifest something. That
mm-hmm.
is not going to happen unless there is some type of action taken in that
middle. An activator.
Middle, an activator.
Right.
And the Holy Spirit is the activator. It's the...
I see.
Right.
Well, and, you know, let me just interject this here, for, again, for my listeners. As soon as you said that, I automatically got this image in my mind that we see so often in Hindu traditions, where you see Kali standing on top of Shiva. And you know, and some people look at that and they understand that to mean she is the activator. Yes, of course, he's a god, but he can't do anything until she activates him. So,
right.
you know, there you have it again, you know, in relation to, you know, the powerful goddess as catalyst.
Right, and what's interesting in some of the creation myths, Babylonian, Sumerian, the, you know, these ancient stories of how the universe came to be, you'll have gods and goddesses that are acting as the creators, and they often will have sex or,
yeah.
you know, take on some other action. There's even one story, and I can't remember what the culture was, where the god vomited life into existence. So
well, I think, isn't it Atum that ejaculates,
the,
you know,
you go.
ejaculates, or, well, and I had a guest on the show some time back. He was a, you know, pretty learned scholar. He translated all of his own Greek. You know, he talked about the idea of even when you had something going on like Zeus raping a woman, you had to take it out of the literal sense of
right.
a man raping a woman, and it was really two elements that came together that were activated to create a third thing.
Right, right. It's much more symbolic
right.
than literal, and I think that happens a lot where we, I mean, people do that with the New Testament, taking things literally that may have been meant in parable or symbolism. And but what's really interesting that we've just found so many connections between Bohm's orders of reality, all of the Trinity symbolism we were seeing, and the law of attraction teachings. And that was really exciting for us because a lot of people have difficulty with the law of attraction. And it's because there's a general misunderstanding of that middle element, the Holy Spirit element, where we have to take some type of action because we are creators. We're told we're made in the image of God. We are divine. So that same cosmic process by which the universe was created, the same Father, Son, Holy Spirit thing that's going on cosmically is going on individually in each one of us. But we get
okay.
really stuck when we don't understand that we are creators, when we don't know what to do to get to create the things that we really want. We don't understand that middle aspect.
So we have to be our own activator is what you're saying.
Well, I think we have to realize that you don't just say a few affirmations in the morning to be able to manifest or create the life you want. It's a lot more work. And the
mm-hmm.
Holy Spirit, in terms of the law of attraction, one of the word that we most associated it with was intention. And this is a word that everybody is talking about. Even in the field of physics, our thoughts and our intentions have power, and especially in a collective sense. And also understanding that a lot of what we create is done subconsciously. We think that we're wanting to create one thing. Our subconscious has a whole different agenda. So we talk a lot about, yeah, you know, I mean, it's, I have so many people say to me, well, I believe in the secret and the law of attraction, but, you know, my life is a mess. The law of attraction doesn't work. And I say, oh, yes, it does. Your life is a mirror of what you've attracted. It works.
Wow.
The law of attraction works for everybody. You just have to be really, really careful that your subconscious is in alignment with what it is you're intending consciously.
Right, or you sabotage yourself.
Absolutely, and all of that stuff occurs in that middle level, that activating level. And also people who think they can just do affirmations, but they don't need to go out into the world and take any kind of action.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, the people
right.
who will say a prayer and hope for a job but won't send out a resume.
Yeah, and there's that old joke of the man that pleaded to God, please let me win the lottery, please, please, please. And God says, well, I would if you'd go out and buy a ticket. You
know? Okay, so, all right, so then, well, I want to know more about the number three and, of course, how we can, you know, use this in our life. But why do you think the number three is so sacred or so profound? I mean, were there clues why that particular, you know, that triune is, you know, more important than any other number?
Yes, and I think, again, on a subconscious level, we respond to this. To the Trinity. We respond to this process of creation because there's a higher part of us that knows that this is how we create and this is how we ourselves were created. So I think we recognize it on a higher level. We don't quite get it intellectually, maybe. And yet, if you look at our culture, if you look at our language and fairy tales and the three-act structure of novels and movies, you know, threes are everywhere. We say, oh, third time's the charm, you know, celebrity deaths come in three. And there's so much of it prevalent in our culture and our language that obviously our subconscious understanding of the profound nature of three is seeping out into our physical reality.
So give a quick example. You know, give a quick example of where this, you know, three plays into folklore or our fairy tales.
Oh my gosh, this is the most fun stuff because I had no idea. People wonder why are there always three bears, three billy goats, three little pigs, three little chickens, and there's a reason for that. And again, it has a lot to do with the process of creation, but it's called progression towards perfection. And what that means is that the stories that we respond to the most, the stories that we take into our hearts and maybe even on a subconscious level we get, are stories that involve three things. Let's take the three little pigs, for example. So as we progress towards perfection, we start out with the smallest and weakest. And that doesn't quite rise up to the challenge that is being presented to it. And then we go to a middle size. It's a little stronger, a little smarter, but still not quite up to that point of being able to overcome the challenge. And finally, we get to the third pig. And this pig is smart and he's strong and he does the trick and he gets the wolf in the pot and boils him for dinner. And again, even with the billy goat scruff story, we have the small goat that doesn't quite get past the troll, the middle goat. You know, they each kind of get savvier, smarter, and stronger as you go up the chain. But it's mm-hmm. always that third entity, I guess you could say. In a lot of fairy tales, you have three challenges. And it's always the third challenge that, if overcome, leads the hero or heroine to whatever it is that they're looking for.
Okay.
And it is this progress that I think we get on a creative level. We get it, again, it's maybe intuitive. We don't necessarily understand intellectually because people think that fairy tales are for children. They are not. They are some of the most profound lessons. They're full of archetypes and symbols, but we just never quite got that because we were focusing intellectually on it. And we hear this in human language with the way we repeat three words, vini, vidi, vici, and, you know, read my lips, no new taxes,
mm-hmm.
and real estate people, location, location, location.
Right, right.
But there's also another reason, and that is because to numerologists, to metaphysicians, to ancient spiritual teachers, duality has always, always made us uncomfortable as human beings. You know, dark, light, day, night, good, evil. We don't like dualities. So the number three unifies dualities into a whole. And the yin-yang symbol is really a perfect example of that, how you've got two symbols that are unified into one whole circle. So that's your it's the number of unification and therefore the number of perfection. So all of this stuff, we get enough to make it so important to us in our language and our culture. But we don't get it on a brain level.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, you know, within goddess spirituality, goddess theology, you know, you have the maiden mother crone,
exactly.
which is the three phases
exactly.
of a woman's life. You also have the triple goddess, you know, so yeah, I mean, so right there you have the sacred three again, like three faces of Hecate, you know. So, all right, so we understand all of that, but then how can we apply it? I mean, how do we actually use it to make life better?
Well, this is the really exciting part for Larry and I, because this book really took us in a different direction, more into the metaphysics, even a little bit of self-help, because what we realized is that if we can grasp this process of creation, which is really so simple, then we come to understand just how powerful we are, and we can turn our lives around. If we begin to look at ourselves as creators and not victims, and not blame everybody and everything else for our lives. If we take responsibility as creators and we take responsibility for what we create, then the only thing left is to work on the act of creation itself. And that is where people need the most help. And there are so many different ways to work on that Holy Spirit level, whether it is reading or journaling, meditating, listening to radio shows like this, you know, going out in nature, getting in touch with that part of yourself that you can then set your intentions from that deeper, higher self rather than the scattered intellectual mind. Because if you set your intentions from that deeper self, chances are you're going to be more in alignment with the subconscious. And a lot of people say you need to do a lot of work cleaning out the subconscious programming. That is hard. And that may require for some people therapy, hypnosis.
So you're talking about, well, all right. Well, let's break it down even a little bit further. You know, I'm one of these people. I tend to understand things better if you give an example. Why don't you give an example of how someone would try to, you know, become the activating agent themselves for something in particular. Does that make sense?
It does, and I wrote about an example that in my life, when I had just read The Secret, I'd just gone through a divorce. This is when I live in Southern California. The entire real estate market had bottomed out. I had a home that was purchased for a lot of money that was now worth very little. A lot of people in my neighborhood were going into foreclosure, and I decided I had to put my house up for sale. It was too big for my son and I. And I said to my realtor, I am not going to foreclosure. I'm not taking a loss. I want to make $100,000 profit. And he laughed at me. But I was so fresh off of, again, renewing my interest and my education in the law of attraction teachings that I was able to do the work where every time I doubted, I wiped out that doubt immediately, and I focused my intention on, instead of focusing my intention and thoughts on how all my neighbors were failing and losing their homes, I focused on what I wanted, because that's
okay.
What's so important. You don't focus on what you don't want, because you'll get more of that.
Right, right.
Believe it or not, 4 months later, I sold my home for $106,000 profit.
Wow.
I was the only one in my neighborhood.
Wow.
And that proved, and you know, and that's just with a house. That
mm-hmm.
proved to me, though, and I still struggle with this concept. It's hard, but that proved to me that when you get in that zone where you just know you can make something happen and there's no fear, no doubt, it will happen. Getting into that zone is the tough part, and it really does require kind of eliminating all the old doubts and beliefs that, oh, I'm not worth, you know, this much money, or I'm not worth a good relationship, and that whole victimhood thing. That has to
go. Yeah, that chatter that gives us the self-doubt that,
right.
You know, that we can't be successful.
Right, right. And I think this applies, too, in healing as well. And, you know, a lot of the books that I read, Dr. Bruce Lipton and Lynn McTaggart, who writes about the zero-point field and how they're, you know, we should be able to heal ourselves. The thing is, though, again, if we are programmed, if the subconscious is programmed to not believe that, we will never be able to heal. There has to be a perfect alignment between the subconscious and the conscious mind where the intentions are being set.
So in your book, do you give, you know, particular steps, you know, to help someone begin to, you know, overcome that, you know, the negative talk in the subconscious and to, you know, actually, you know, learn how to do this manifesting?
One of the things that we included was in my New Thought teachings was, it's called scientific prayer. And it's a five-step way of praying or setting intention that is very successful for a lot of people, because what it does, instead of, most people when they pray, they beg, they plead. And what they're putting out into the universe is, I'm desperate, I need. And what they're getting back from the universe is more things to be desperate about or more things to need. What scientific prayer does is you start out by first coming into, it's sort of an altered state of consciousness where you come into an understanding that you are a creator and you are one with God. You have this divine energy. The same energy that created you is in you. So you get into this really great zone of understanding that you are a powerful person. Then you set your intention, and you set it strongly. And I'm not going to necessarily go through all five of the steps, but then you give thanks that it has already been received, because that's very important to wipe out the doubt. And you end the prayer with, and so it is. Amen is another way of saying, let it be, so let it be, which sort of wraps up the prayer. And then you let go. And what a lot of people do is when they pray for something or when they intend something, they think about it every day. Well, why isn't it here? Why isn't it here yet? Oh, maybe I didn't do it right.
Well, that's putting out negative juju.
Absolutely. And there's and Sandra Ann Taylor wrote a book called Quantum Success. I love her work. And she came up with a great example that's so visual, where you put your order into the universal warehouse for what you want. The universe goes to work immediately fulfilling that order. But then what do? We cancel it with our doubt and fear. So then the guys in the universal warehouse put our stuff back on the shelf. And, you know, we keep doing this sort of in a cycle. We ask for something, then we doubt it, we don't believe we're worth it, back it goes on the shelf.
Right.
And it's just the idea of that middle work that needs to be done where you... And a lot of people have done this. They've cured themselves of cancer. They just get into this zone of acceptance, not necessarily even belief, but they just accept it as their reality, even if it's not manifested yet.
Well, you know, you're making me, you know, you're causing me to connect a lot of dots here, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, it reminds me of the saying that my husband always tells me. You know, he says, you know, you get what you expect. You know,
oh, absolutely.
You get what you expect, or you get what you give too. You know, what
right.
you put out in the world, you know, it just comes back to you.
Exactly.
You know, and I'm thinking about a woman who was on the show Survivor a number of years ago, and when they asked her about, you know, how, and she ended up winning it, not just getting on the show, you know, being selected, but actually winning the big money. She was the last one standing at the end. And, you know, she talked about a little bit of what you're saying, really. You know, she said every day she looked at this post-it note on her computer screen that said she was going to be selected for Survivor, and then when she got selected, she had a note that said, I'm going to win. And she just didn't, you know, she seemed, I don't know if these were her words, but I understood her to be saying, you don't let doubt enter the picture. You
right.
know, you just move forward in confidence. Like you said, as if it's already happened and it's a done deal and you're just, you know, waiting for the closing date, kind of.
Right, exactly. And what's hard for a lot of people to understand is that you can set all the intentions in the world, but if you're not putting strong emotion and passion and enthusiasm behind them, they don't have any power. And so, in other words, if you're setting a specific intention, the best way to make it manifest quickly is to get into the feeling, the emotions and the feeling and the sensations, kind of like acting as if
right.
it's already here. And a lot of people will say, well, how can I act rich if, you know, I'm living in poverty? Just do it. Try it. It's not working the other way, you know.
Right. Makes perfect makes perfect sense.
Right.
You know, I feel like you're talking to me at just the perfect time for myself, too, because I have some projects on the back burner that are finally up at the front burner, and I want to use this this Trinity secret to, you know, move forward in confidence and without any doubt.
Right.
So now, would you say this is what they call the law of attraction? Is it the same thing?
I think it's the same thing, but I think it's a better description because, again, what happened with most people, when the law of attraction went, quote-unquote, mainstream, a lot of people took it to be wishful thinking and that if they just wished for something, it would manifest right before their eyes, and that's not what the law of attraction teachings are at all. They're ancient teachings. They've been modernized, but it really does take a lot of work. And you have to understand that three-part process because if you don't understand that you are the creator, again, you're giving responsibility and power away to something or someone else.
Right.
So
you're saying, you know, you don't, if say just for instance you have a home altar, you don't stand at the home altar and, like you said, beg, you know, the deity that lives up in the heavens to give this to you. You know that you are, you know, you are part of making this happen. You're, you know, somebody isn't just going to bestow this upon you.
Exactly, because again, if you beg for something, all you're going to get is more situations or more things to beg. This is really obvious in love or personal relationships where, you know, people repeat the same patterns in a relationship over and over, and then they can't understand why. Well, it's because there's a part of them that is putting out that's attracting the same thing over and over, and they actually, it's like they actually want that on a certain level, maybe so they can overcome the pattern, but if you plead or beg or oh, I wish I could have this, all you're going to get is more reason to wish for something. But if you intend, if you declare, I even read in one book that you should demand from the universe what you want, not in an angry way, but in a very confident way, because you are a part of that universe. You're a part of the creation process. So what you're doing is you're firmly demanding that that be recognized. And
so
I thought that was interesting.
So just to go over the three parts. All right, so we are the creator or creatrix.
We are the God aspect. We are the
God.
And this is the individual Trinity. Again, this occurs on a cosmic scale that we don't necessarily understand how it works. But we're here, and that's proof that it works. But on the individual level, yes, we're the creators. We're the God.
All right, and then what's the second one?
The Holy Spirit, the middle level, are the actions and intentions and thoughts that we take on a daily basis that will create.
That are sort of feeding what it is we desire.
Right. And then, of course, the sun aspect, look around you, your job, your spouse, your kids, your home, every physical thing that you have drawn into your life, every experience is the sun aspect. It is the manifest.
So that's the result in a sense.
Right. And a good way to understand how good you are at attracting good things into your life is to look at what you have. And you begin to realize, okay, if I've attracted a really lousy job, I need to work on that part of me that believes this is all I deserve. If I attract an abusive spouse, I need to work on understanding that I am a creator, I am divine, I deserve better.
So when
you look around at your physical manifestations that we call our lives, we can kind of see where we need to do more work or where we're doing really well.
Right. So we are, I mean, this might sound cliche, but it's, you know, maybe it's important to reiterate it. We are creating our own reality with our own thoughts because they're things.
Right.
You know, that's energy that we are putting out there. So
exactly.
You
know, again, even if you're Christian and you're saying, well, no, God does all this, in the Bible, we are told that we were made in the image of God, and Jesus said we can do all things that he does, even greater things, if we understand who we are.
Well, and I mean, you could even think of it. I mean, if you don't want to let go of the concept, I guess, that there is a deity up there, you know, the idea that we're all interconnected and we are divine ourselves, you know, it's almost like, you know, maybe, you know, we are, there's a conduit that, you know, that sort of helps us connect to that higher power, which makes us part of that higher power.
Right.
I mean, does that make sense? Or?
It does. And even if you're an atheist, the law of attraction works. And quantum physics is a great place to look for the reasons why, because as an observer in a quantum experiment, will affect the outcome of the experiment. So the observer is actually creating reality at the quantum level. And
oh,
also,
can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, with experiments done with photons, light particles, and it would take a long time for me to get into explaining the actual experiment, but there's no such thing as a particle. Everything at the quantum level exists in a state of superposition, which means it's both wave and particle at the same time until something observes it. The second that happens, it becomes a particle, measurable, fixed, a thing. So the observer has the power to determine what it is in that state of superposition that they're going to observe into reality.
Huh.
Now, if this is going on a grander scale, and a lot of metaphysicians and even quantum physicists are starting to talk to each other about, hey, this may actually be happening, that may be how we are observing our reality into being.
I would think being an observer is pretty passive, but you're saying just by being a passive observer, you are affecting things. So
right.
if we are looking at, let's just say, you know, horrible news on the television every night,
right.
We are in a sense perpetuating the negativity.
You are, because it's not enough to just be an observer. You have to make choices about what it is you want to observe into your reality. And again, if you don't like the negative news, turn it off, and I guarantee you, your reality will become more buoyant and lighter and happier. But again, if there is this state of superposition, which basically means that everything is vibrating, everything is in a state of waves until we fix it into position, then that means you don't have to believe in God. That stuff, that source energy is out there. And it takes your thoughts, your focused intention, your belief, if you want, and just the actions that you need to take something out of that source energy and create it into something physical that you can actually see or an experience that you desire.
So how do we, as someone who's really interested in social transformation, how do we take this beyond ourselves to make the world a better place?
If on an individual level, this is what's so exciting about living in the times that we're in, you know, if on an individual level we have the power to create, collectively, if we put collective intention to work, and this has been done already with the black box, I don't know if you heard about the random event generators, they're boxes that are used at the peer laboratory that say an event like September 11th, what they did is they record the intentions of the public. They actually show that during these events, these random generated numbers actually have some kind of pattern because there's such a collective fear or emotional response to an event. Princess Diana's death, the same thing happened. So there actually are ways to start registering and measuring the power of collective thought, intention, emotion, reaction. And people can read about that in any number of wonderful books out there on quantum physics, or Lynn McTaggart's The Field, books by Fred Allen Wolf, F. David Peet. Oh, there's so many of them out there that are talking about how these intention experiments are occurring. You could even find them online.
Okay.
So what that means is that collectively, if we stop blaming everybody and everything else, we realize our power as creators, and we come together to collectively intend a specific future. We can make it happen. The problem is getting people to take responsibility, getting them to take back their power, especially women, and coming up with that very specific collective intention and really, really focusing on it.
So you think what holds us back is the doubt that it can't be any different, that things are never going to change?
I think it's doubt. I think it's people focusing on their religious and political beliefs instead of the understanding that beyond all that, we're all the same and we're all connected. You know, we need to focus more on our humanity rather than our political or religious affiliations. I think there's just way too much focus on that.
So it's almost as if we would put the energy into, you know, thinking how we would like the world to be. I mean, it almost seems too foo-foo. You know what I mean? It almost seems too passive. I can't think of the word right now. But it doesn't. Here I'm feeding the self-doubt, okay?
Right. Well, no, I understand, you know, you're thinking if everybody sits around and meditates on world peace, sure, you're putting out good energy. But again, you have to take those actions and get out there and make it happen, because that combined, you know, actions combined with intention has the most incredible power to create and manifest. But any good energy that is put out there collectively is certainly going to help shift. And I think that's what's happening now. Everybody I talk to feels a big shift coming. And the vast majority of people feel it's going to be a difficult one, but in the end, a positive one.
Well, does that tie into your other book where I see the title 2013, End of Days or a New Beginning?
It does. It does. And in that book, I sort of brought together all of the different theories and stories and mythologies and conspiracy stories and everything I could find on the 2012 enigma, from the Mayan calendar to Planet X and singularity of technology, everything I could find. And then I looked at some of the more realistic challenges that we were going to face. But what I found was that there really is very little evidence for the apocalyptic doom and gloom stuff. But there seems to be growing evidence for some kind of shift in consciousness, mirrored by a technological explosion that I think we're already experiencing.
In what field? I mean, are you talking about maybe energy or what technological field?
Oh, gosh, computer processing, for one thing, is now. It used to take 25 years for us to double the amount of information that could be processed by a computer at the time. That's now happening maybe yearly, maybe even every 6 months. We're doubling the capacity, and things are getting smaller and faster. There is an acceleration of exponential technological growth, especially in the computer field, because that is what we are so attached to. Where, you know, we have the threat of them actually overtaking us someday, but the way things are going, I would say by next year, you know, we will have a quantum computer. We will have the fastest computers. We won't even be able to imagine the speed of their processing information. Cell phones are getting more and more complex. Smartphones, they're going to be genius phones pretty soon. But
so
while all that's happening, if we don't make those same shifts as human beings, we're going to get left behind. We're going to have technology overtake our humanity.
Right. Well, it feels like we're almost there now when
yeah.
you see how regressed some of our humanity is.
Right.
But I guess, do you think some of the things we're seeing happening out in the world, like, you know, the upheavals and protests in the Middle East, the, you know, Wisconsin and the workers, you know, sort of waking up and fighting back against Republicans. I mean, all of this stuff, do you think that this is part of the shift?
Yeah, I think because more and more people are realizing they need to take back their power, that they need to take responsibility for how their lives turn out. You know, in the Middle East and Libya and in the protests there in Egypt, I mean, those are countries where you would normally be killed if you hit the streets, you know, and that's happening in Libya right now, but people are doing it anyway. It's
right.
almost as if a wave of understanding has passed over the world where we've sort of been lifted up to the next level. It's like, we have power. Let's use it for good. Let's build real democracy in the world. Let's get rid of corporate and military influence. And that seems to be happening faster and faster and spreading. And I love it. I love it. I just think
And I think here in the United States, where we haven't been, well, I guess some would say some of us have been oppressed, but we have certainly been complacent.
Absolutely.
Rather than, like what you've said, we haven't been, taking charge of our own lives. We've sort of just been letting, government and plutocracy sort of just do their own thing, and then we wake up one day and we go, oh, gee, we're screwed,
Yeah, one of the things I say all the time is, what is it going to take for Americans to hit the streets?
Right.
I've been to protests. I come from a real activist background. What does it take, though, to get those complacent, lazy people who have pretty much given up on their own power to get out there and hit the streets? We're spoiled brats. We
right.
have to really be backed into a corner in order to realize, okay, wait a second, corporations, you do not own me. Government, wait a second. Too much money going here, not enough going here. But I think that's starting to happen. More and more people are waking up. And what's interesting is to see the growing resistance from the other side, because they realize they're losing power. They're going to hold on to it as tightly as they can
until that
paradigm shifts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're not gonna not gonna give up easily.
They're
not gonna go down without a fight.
This next election is gonna be really interesting.
Oh, you're not kidding. I've been waiting for us to hit the streets.
Yeah.
I just haven't. It just seems like enough people haven't been adversely affected yet.
They will be.
I think so. Well, Marie, I see my second guest is on the switchboard, so I'm just going to ask you one more question before we wrap it up. And maybe it's a quick answer. I can't let you go without asking this, because it'll just burn in my brain all night. the book that you wrote about how new discoveries in quantum physics and new science may explain the existence of paranormal phenomena, does that mean you can explain what ghosts are?
What it does is it offers several new theories that may actually explain. And a lot of them are based in quantum theoretical physics and new science, which is the study of consciousness in the human brain. So, yes, we're offering and I'm not the only one writing about this stuff, some bold new theories that may finally explain what is going on, because the theories of the past have not done that.
Okay. Well, can you give us a little hint, and then you can come back on the show and explain it in more detail?
Well, I will. Let's talk about ghosts, because everybody's into ghost hunting and ghosts, and basically people think ghosts are the essence of a dead person.
Yeah.
In my research, I found that a lot of ghostly sightings act more like holographic projections, which means that they could be images of a living person in another dimension. They could be images of someone in a parallel universe, because quantum theoretical physics is telling us every day parallel universes are probably a reality. Now we just have to find out how to figure out where they are. That's one example. Ghosts do not have to be the essence of a dead person. They may be some of the time, but a lot of the cases that I've seen do not behave that way. And the same thing with UFOs.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, finish that thought.
Well, just the same thing is that the types of sightings don't play into the typical nuts and bolts shift from Venus. People reporting that they appeared instantaneously and then vanished instantaneously, which again is some type of projection.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to greet my next guest. I am also sorry to have to end our conversation. So I will email you tomorrow, and we'll talk about another date to come
Absolutely.
On and talk about all the paranormal activity.
I would love to. I'd be thrilled.
Well, that's not normally something we talk about on the show, but, I know my listeners would enjoy it. It would be a lot of fun.
Yes.
So, Marie, thank you so much. I have so enjoyed the subject, because, when we first started talking about this, I didn't realize how we could use this, this Trinity theory, this creation theory, as actually self-help tools, to
it
help
really
us manifest a better world,
Right.
I was thinking we were just going to talk about all the ancient Trinity 70s and, you know, how that was relevant. But it's really so much more important than that, you know, tying into universal truths and how we can make our world better. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I look forward to talking to you again.
Oh, absolutely. Good night and have a wonderful week.
Oh, you too. Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that. We were just talking to our friend Marie Jones, and she's the author of The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creations. I can't wait to go out and get her book, actually, and learn those five steps toward manifesting. I think we know a lot of those steps intuitively, but maybe we have to remind ourselves to stay focused, to stay intent and on track. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks certainly have the ability to change the world. And if you hear that sound, you know we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show. And my next guest is Yaba Badeau, and I'm so glad to have her with us. Let me unmute her and say hello, and we'll be able to start our chat. Hi, Yaba. Are you there?
Hi, Karen. Hi, Karen. How are you?
Oh, I'm really good, and I want to thank you so much. I feel so lucky that we have you on the show tonight, because usually you're across the pond.
That's right.
And we just got lucky that you were in the States this week, and I appreciate it so much, you having, allowed me to view a film of your documentary, and also taking the time to be on the show. So let me start with thanks and gratitude.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
Well, let me tell listeners a little bit about you and what's going on, and then we'll jump in and talk about the film. So listeners, Yaba Badeau, she actually lives in London. She is a Ghanaian-British documentary filmmaker and writer. She's a graduate of King's College, Cambridge. She worked as a civil servant in Ghana before becoming a general trainee with the BBC. She's taught in Spain and Jamaica and has worked as a producer and director making documentaries for the main terrestrial channels in Britain and the University of Ghana in Accra. Her short stories have been published in Critical Quarterly and in African Love Stories, an anthology edited by Ama Alta Edu, I think. I hope I got that right.
Yeah.
And in 2009, her first novel, True Murder, was published by Jonathan Cape. Her TV credits include Black and White, a groundbreaking investigation into race and racism in Bristol, using hidden video cameras for BBC One. Also, I Want Your Sex for Channel 4 and a six-part series VSO for ITV. African Love Stories is now available in Swedish from Trainin Publishers under the title Parlek Times 21. Did I get that all right?
Yes, you got that all right. You got everything. You said everything that was right. Yeah, Karen.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, listeners, Yaba is the director and producer of an award-winning documentary. It won the Best Documentary at the Black International Film Festival in 2010, I believe. Anytime I get any of this wrong, Yaba, feel free to correct me. You don't have
to. Okay. So far, you're doing really well. You're doing very well.
Well, this documentary she made, The Witches of Gumbaga, I have to tell you, I was blown away when I saw this. It's the extraordinary story of a community of women condemned to live as witches in northern Ghana. And what really got me was, in watching the film, Yaba, how vulnerable these women were, how the slightest accusation could just turn their lives upside down. And then after they're accused with no real proof, you know, the way the authorities, let's call them the authorities, determine if the woman is really a witch, if she's really guilty, is how a chicken dies. Why don't you tell listeners a little bit about, you know, how you stumbled upon these witches that have found sanctuary in Gumbaga, and you know, just sort of tell them the story of these poor women, and then I have some questions for you.
Okay. Well, what happened was that in 1995, I was working as a stringer for the BBC World Service, making features for a program called Network Africa. And I was doing a story up in the north, and as we were traveling around, one of the civil servants who was escorting me sort of pointed to some burnt-out huts and said, oh, that used to be a witch's camp. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, oh, yes, yes, we have witches up here. The camp in Gumbaga is still intact. Why don't you go and visit it? So I decided to do just that and went up in the March of 1995 to Gumbaga. And I thought it would be just a simple day trip in and out, but I was denied permission. I had to wait for the district commissioner to return from whatever he was doing before I got permission to speak to the women. And so I spent an extraordinary evening, when I was given permission, talking to women who said that they were witches and believed they were witches. And because I had been so delayed, I stayed there late. And I had to spend the night in Gumbaga. And when the electricity, I mean, actually there was no electricity, when the kerosene lamp faded and I was lying on a bed in my clothes with my shoes on, I suddenly thought, what would happen if I was accused of witchcraft? And what would I do if the ritual went against me? How would I get word to my parents down south? And the next morning, I sort of got up very early and fled, more or less. The story had gripped me, and I just was so eager to try to understand what was going on and how it was that just about 40 kilometers from where I was born in Tamale, there was a camp for women who said they were witches. So it's been a very long journey actually making the film and doing the research, and now having the film come out on DVD.
Well, first question is, does this village of witches still exist today?
Yes, Gumbaga, the witches' camp in Gumbaga is still there. The numbers, when I first went, the number of witches living there, so-called witches, was about 160. Now it's about 80, thanks to the work of the Presbyterian Church of Ghana, which is gradually trying to rehabilitate women who are believed to be witches. However, when I started the research, there was about 1,000 women altogether living in witches' camps in northern Ghana. Now there are 3,000. So it goes to show that the problem is actually getting worse.
Well, let me ask you this, and forgive me if this is totally unrelated, but from, you know, information that crosses my desk, you know, I've heard, I want to understand where this fear of witchcraft comes from. And, you know, we hear a lot, you know, in the news about, you know, now that Africa is becoming so Christian, that a lot of this fear of witchcraft is actually coming from Christians, just like the C Street people here, you know, the Christians were promoting you know, the death of, you know, killing gays, you know, over in Africa too. You know, that Christianity really is, unfortunately, seems in sometimes, I want to stress, to sort of be the catalyst or the bad influence for this kind of stuff. Is that what's happening here, or does Christianity have anything to do with these people being so focused on witchcraft?
No, I think African traditional religions, witchcraft is quite a prominent idea, quite a prominent belief in many African traditional religions. And what seems to be happening is that these beliefs are fused with Islam and with Christianity, so that people when they want an explanation for why life isn't going well for them, why they're stressed, why somebody dies suddenly, why a child dies, why a woman dies in childbirth, instead of looking at reasons to do with the state and the lack of provision of healthcare or education, we'll say, well, we'll try to look for a scapegoat. And I think this isn't something that's peculiar to Africans. I think throughout generations, human beings have looked for scapegoats for social ills. And
sure.
Now at the moment, I think around the world, many poor and vulnerable people are being scapegoated for actually an economic crisis that was caused by the financial system. And I
Thank
think
you.
In Ghana at the moment, it's very much that, you know, women are bearing the brunt of the tremendous anxiety to do with the very, very bad economic situation, which many people living in poorer parts of the world are experiencing as a result of the world economic crisis.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that crossed my mind as I watched these women was that most of these women, not all, but it seemed like at least the ones that, their stories you put on the screen, most of these women were older women. And we know in the West anyway, older women tend to be sometimes more disposable. Do you think that plays into this at all?
I think it does. I think it's partly that older women are more disposable, but also I think when a woman hits menopause and is growing older, she's much harder to control. Older women tend to be more independent and more willing to voice their displeasure in a sort of patriarchal system. And I think the reason why women are named as witches is actually an excellent form of social control to keep women in their place.
Well, another thing that surprised me was it seemed that the women accepted the idea that they were witches. Do they do that for expediency, just so that, you know, if they're being thrown out of their village and thrown out of their family, they need a place to go, so they go, okay, I'm a witch if it means I'll have a roof over my head? Or have they been convinced now that they're witches?
I think it's a combination of all those things. I think, first of all, the women are part of the climate of belief that actually scapegoats women. So, you know, often it might be women who accuse other women of being witches. But then on top of that, the way the system works is that, you know, if you don't confess to being a witch, and often some women are beaten viciously, some are tortured. And we all know that if people are put under tremendous pressure, they will confess to anything. And one of the things about being at the camp at Gambagra is that the first step to leaving is accepting that you're a witch. So it's actually quite a complicated psychological game that everybody's playing.
Right.
But the important thing is that the camp provides sanctuary for the women.
Well, and there was one woman, I couldn't help but think about the days of the Inquisition where, you know, we've learned that it really sort of became a cottage industry. There were people who were making money off the Inquisition. It was convenient to name a neighbor a witch because maybe you wanted their land and their property.
Yes.
I mean, all of these different sorts of things. I mean, you even showed a woman who was pretty well off at her own business.
That's
and
right.
She ends up in the camp, and I think she ended up losing her business and everything.
Yes, it was really, I mean, it was during the meningitis epidemic of 1997 in a town called Gushiagu. And during the epidemic, three women, all of whom were very well-to-do and ran successful businesses. The problem for the women was that they were heading their own households. They were living without men and raising their children without men, which for many people in the city was considered, you know, not the thing to do. It was like people say that if a woman makes money without the help of a man, that woman is a witch. And during the epidemic, all three of those women were accused of causing the epidemic. And Azara, who I got to know quite well, was forced out of her property. And in the film, we take her back to where she used to live. And the house, which had been her pride and joy, it had been her mother's house, and she'd taken it over and added bedrooms and grew flowers in front, it was just a dump, in fact, and she was devastated to see what had become of her home. And
now,
now
we see in the film that men can also be accused of witchcraft, but they get to stay in their house. They're not cast out.
No, I think it's partly because men control the system there, the land tenure, and it's a sort of very patriarchal system. And what the women said to me, one of them, Sanaba, said, in our system, men get, even if they're accused of witchcraft, they get to stay because they own the homes, they own the land, whilst the woman has nowhere to go, so she has to go to the witch's camp.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, maybe it just didn't get conveyed in the documentary, and maybe I'm underestimating how much these women love their family. But, you know, life didn't look a whole lot better when they went home compared to, you know, being in Gumbaga. What was I missing? I mean, it didn't seem like in a lot of cases their village, their families were excited about having them back. I don't know. I guess I don't know if I'd want to go back. And what do you think about that?
Well, what struck me about most of the women I met, all the women I met, in fact, was how much they wanted to go home. And if you can think, if you sort of think of Gumbaga, although it's a sanctuary, it's also a place of punishment where you're stigmatized by society and where you are living thanks to the kindness or thanks to the expediency of the chief of Gumbaga. And most women, I think, all over the world want to be with their children when they're growing older, want to have to be cared for and have people cooking for them. And so even though the women who we follow back in the film, going back to their homes, even though, you know, they're more or less placed under house arrest by the village elders, all of them were really delighted to be home again.
Now, some of the women seemed, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seemed like some of them were accused of witchcraft maybe by rival women. Did you find that, or was it more so men who just didn't like that these women were uppity and uncontrollable or had too much of their own money, or is it just a mixed bag of how they get accused of witchcraft?
I think it's a mixture. It can be your rival, because people are poor in northern Ghana. Women are competing with other women in polygamous households, in a household where a man is married to more than one woman at a time. The women are sort of pitted against each other to sort of try to get the larger share of whatever's going. And like when women are rivals, that's the term that is used. They're competing as far as who has more sons, who has whose children are doing better. So the whole system, I think, is geared to women competing against each other. Yet, in spite of that, many women who are married to the same man cooperate with each other, and sometimes it's men who accuse women of witchcraft because for some reason a woman has done something that has made her go against the gender regimes in the north. Like she has dared to say that she doesn't want her younger daughter married off to an elderly man. So it's usually women who in some way transgressed were accused of witchcraft.
I see. Well, and this didn't come up in the film, but I couldn't help but wonder about it. Are these women that are, you know, have been subjected to female genital mutilation, that sort of suffering early in life?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know those details, and that wasn't my field questioning.
Really,
it was more actually what it is about women that means that they're accused of witchcraft.
Right. Well, now explain a little bit, if you would, to listeners how, you know, the things that would happen that would suddenly cause a woman to realize she had been accused of witchcraft, and then that test that would be given to determine if she was guilty or innocent.
Well, like I mentioned, Azara, it was a meningitis epidemic, and people accused three of the women, of which she was one, of being guilty of starting the epidemic. The test that's done, or the ritual, is that a chicken is killed, and depending on how the chicken dies, that determines whether you're a witch or not.
Not that different from the witch trials, where if you sank or floated, kind of a thing, you lost either way almost.
Yeah.
Well, what I thought was really interesting too is the what do you call him? Is he the king or the village leader? I forget what you call
the chief.
The chief. Thank you, chief. Boy, you know, he's got a pretty good deal, doesn't he? It seems like it's almost as if he's created an industry of providing these women sanctuary. I mean, should I be looking at it negatively like that? I mean, because that's sort of how I felt about it, and maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I think what you feel is what you feel, but like I say in the film, and you know, an important part of the film is that it's made with the support of the women's movement in Ghana, who want to use the film as a resource for advocacy. What I say is that it's not a clear-cut case of good guys and bad guys. The fact is, even if the chief is using the women and gains a lot of prestige from the women, if they weren't given sanctuary, they would be killed in their home communities. So, you know, he is providing quite an important service.
So he's giving them sanctuary. So that's the pro side.
Yes.
But the con side is they're almost like indentured servants, and they also have to pay him if they leave. Right? Am I remembering correctly?
The families have to pay him if they leave. Yes.
Okay. Obviously it seems from the numbers, the decrease, so you said it was the Presbyterian folks who are being instrumental in helping this situation out?
That is, in the witches' camp at Gambaga, they're being very, very helpful. But as far as the northern region as a whole, in 1995, when I was doing the research, it was... there were 1,000 women living as witches. Now there are over 3,000. So I think the economic pressure that people are living under is meaning that many more women are being accused of witchcraft.
Well, and we've also seen here in the United States, even children are being accused of witchcraft. But I don't know if that's in Ghana. It could be somewhere else. I mean, have you heard anything?
In Ghana, where the let's say charismatic churches are involved in witch hunting, that is where children are being accused of witchcraft. But in the north, it's predominantly women.
Okay. Well, Yaba, what haven't I asked that you'd like listeners to know about the plight of these women and your documentary?
Well, we have a website for the documentary, which is www.witchesofgambaga.com, where anybody who's interested in finding out more about the issues can look to find out more. Or if they're interested in purchasing a DVD, that's where you can purchase a DVD. And I think the thing to remember is that this film wouldn't have been made without the support of my co-producer, Amina Mama, who teaches gender studies at the University of Davis in California, or without the support of the women's movement in Ghana, who were really, really instrumental in helping us get financing to complete the documentary.
Well, besides, projects like this, what other things is the women's movement over there? Do you know what they're involved in?
I think their main concern is trying to get gender justice. And so they're looking at inequalities in land tenure systems and so on. But it's mostly, it's broad spectrum of things which can be described as trying to correct gender injustices within Ghanaian society.
I would imagine it everything from education to health to you know, just all of those sorts of things that that women
definitely
need to uplift themselves. You know, maybe even investment in women's businesses. Although that could get you in trouble. I just couldn't help but getting the feeling I would be afraid to go to sleep at night because the next day I could wake up and find myself accused of being a witch and potentially sent off to Gumbaga. It's pretty scary.
That's what was the initial thing that made me want to make a film was I was frightened. I thought, well, it can happen to me. It can happen to any woman who is vulnerable in some way and is without the protection of a father or a husband or a good son. It's so easy to be accused when people are searching for explanations. But like I said, I do think there is something in human nature. I mean, like, for instance, if you look at the current spate of Islamophobia around the world and the need to blame Muslims for problems, or if you think about how the Nazis scapegoated the Jews,
right?
There seems to be a psychological need across generations to blame people for what is not going right.
No, that makes perfect sense. Well, most of these women, are they of a particular religious tradition?
Well, like I said, it's mixed. It's mixed Christians and Muslims, but like most of them are imbued, have traditional African beliefs as well.
Okay. It's sort of just a syncretized sort of blend. The documentary has won some awards. Why don't you tell listeners how well it's been received?
Well, it's been done well. It won the best documentary at the Black International Film Festival in Britain in 2010, and it won second prize for best documentary at FESPACO, which is the biggest and best of the African film festivals, which is held every 2 years in Burkina Faso, which is just up from Ghana. It's a country which is very famous for its film festival, and we premiered it in Ghana. We launched it in Ghana in February, and since then I've been sort of taking the film with my co-producer at times to various festivals. It's been to Cinema Africa, which is in Sweden, in Stockholm, and now it went to the New York African Film Festival, and now we've just shown it yesterday in the Bay Area at Mills College, and it was a really good screening last night.
Good, good. I'm just curious, have any of the women depicted in the film, have they seen the finished product?
Simon Ngota and Gladys Laraba, who we feature, who are the workers from the Presbyterian Church, they have seen the film, and they were at the launch in Accra. And in mid-July, we're taking it up to the north to launch it up there so that some of the women who were filmed will see themselves, because it's really important that they see how they're contributing to changing the status quo in Ghana.
Absolutely. Well, Yaba, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the show and for doing this important work. These women definitely needed a heroine, and I think you are part of that. And thank you for bringing it to the rest of the world so that we can see what's going on the other side of the globe, because I doubt that most people think about stuff like this. They can't imagine that these sorts of atrocities might be happening to their sisters, across the globe.
Well, Karen, thank you very much for having me on your program. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you, and I'll just mention your website again, and I really recommend listeners go take a look. It's witchesofgambaga.com, and that's G-A-M-B-A-G-A. Thank you so much, Yab.
Bye.
I appreciate you being on the show. Good
okay,
night.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, what a sad story. Imagine your fate, being in the hands of basically how a chicken writhes in pain as it dies. That's what we're talking about here. Anyway, well, we have a few more minutes, so I want to share with listeners who our upcoming guests are going to be in April. In May. Can you believe April is already come and gone? Well, on May 4th, we're going to have Dan Poitras on the show. He calls himself the most radical female feminist alive, and he's actually going to talk about his brush with parthenogenesis. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, a woman who he knows rather well experienced what just may be a contemporary case of parthenogenesis. And the way I met Dan was through Marguerite Rigoglioso, who is a favorite here on the show. She talked about parthenogenesis in her past two books. And it was the woman who Dan Poitras spent a lot of time with that Marguerite mentioned when I interviewed her, and I asked, well, are there any contemporary women who have experienced parthenogenesis? And when she said yes, anyway, Dan is going to talk to us about his experiences with this woman, because he certainly believes that that is what he saw happening in this woman's life. Then on May 18th, yes, we're skipping a week because as of right now at least, it may change, but we may not have a show the second Wednesday of May, but I'm going to make it up later on in the month. On May 18th, Tammy Kent is going to be with us. She is the author of The Wild Feminine. She's going to discuss learning from the female body, also about how we should be giving boys greater access to the feminine concept, how we learn to run feminine energy through our bodies, in our bodies, and lives, so that we might shift into this new paradigm that we're always talking about from so many different aspects. And she believes this, these principles and what she has learned helps us access our true creative potential. So Tammy Kent, you'll want to make sure you tune in that night, see if she has some tips to help your life be more fulfilled. Then on May 25th, Jeannie Sable, she's going to talk about GMOs, genetically modified food, how that's working against Mother Nature. And then the next night on Thursday, this is when I'm making up for not having a show the second week in May, on the 26th, we're going to have the filmmaker of the docudrama Bloodline on the show. Bloodline was the movie that was about the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And there have been updates to this whole saga, this whole investigation about the Holy Grail, the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And Rene Barrett, he is the filmmaker I'm talking about. He is going to give us some updates and some new revelations of what he's discovered in France, and as far as the descendants that we think may be descendants of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So, interesting stuff for the rest of May. I hope you will tune in with us. And just some other quick things here while we still have a few minutes. I just want you to remember my personal motto, "Have Sistrum Will Travel." I'm available to talk to your group or church if you'd like to sponsor me to your city. And I just put some YouTube clips up on my channel. If you go to YouTube and just punch in Karen Tate, you'll find me, or you can get directly to my YouTube channel from my website, KarenTate.com. I have three new YouTube clips up there. One is when I address the Theosophical Society on Values of the Sacred Feminine, and the other was when I gave a paper at the American Academy of Religion talking about goddess theology or ecofeminism for a sustainable future. And it's titled Goddess is a Democrat because it is a very political, politically oriented piece, because quite frankly, it's hard to talk about this stuff without telling how these ideas, how this theology, ideology, spirituality, whatever you want to call it, how it could affect the outcome, outcomes in the world, how it can affect politics, how it can affect who we might choose to vote for, who we might choose to put our energy behind, how we can reconcile our spirituality and our politics, because what I've discovered is a lot of people, even goddess advocates, I don't think they've connected the dots yet. So I try to help with some of these YouTube clips. So I hope you'll take a look at them and email me. Let me know what you think. Also, I want to remind listeners that my husband and I are leading a tour to Turkey to Sacred Sites of Goddess in November of this year. The tour is for men and women. Wonderful itinerary, great price. We're going to be doing ritual at a lot of the sacred sites, and we're very lucky in Turkey. It is not overrun with tourists yet, and the last time we took a group there, we were able to do ritual with the site totally unoccupied except for us there. I mean, we had total privacy. We're also going to experience the wonderful energy of the whirling dervishes. There are hot springs near the Temple of Aphrodite that we are going to partake some of the sacred mineral springs. So this is a great trip for your left and right brain. You will learn a lot about goddess and her story, but you will also be doing ritual and dream incubations and all the other right brain stuff. So, it encompasses the literal history, herstory, as well as the experiential. So, we try to cover both sides. Also, too, I'd like to invite you to go get the freebies that I have on my website. If you go to KarenTate.com and go to the Goddess Store page and you scroll down past my books, you will find I have free downloadable meditations there. Some of them are perfect for the season. There's an Ostara one there. There's a spring meditation to take you to the Isis Temple on sacred pilgrimage. There's a Sekhmet meditation there. Gotten good feedback from the meditations. So please partake of them. They're there for you to enjoy. And always interested in feedback. Let me know if you downloaded them, if you listened, if you liked what you heard. And while you're there, go ahead, look at my two books. I have a special deal, both books $25 plus shipping and handling. One is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. Takes you to sacred places of goddess all around the world, whether you're an armchair tourist or someone who actually has the opportunity to go to those places. You hear about the goddess, you hear about the history, you get a sense of her and the place, and there's how to get there information as well, if you can actually make a trip. And the second book, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, well, it was an award winner, a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Books Awards. And if you're looking for a way to understand how to incorporate goddess as deity archetype or ideal into your life. It's a good book. I think you can use. It's sort of a reflection of how I've done that, how our community has done that. You know, lots of good practical information as well as rituals and meditations and stories of sacred pilgrimage, with, you know, what we've experienced on journeys to places around the world. So anyway, take a look at that. Well, the show is coming to a close for tonight. I want to thank you for tuning in. And since we have time tonight, I'd like to just leave you with an evening prayer. And this one comes, compliments of the Goddess Temple in Orange County, where I teach sometimes, or I'll guest minister. And this is the prayer for April, and it goes like this. Great Goddess, your signs and symbols are all around me, and I notice. Spring is in the air, and with it change, sometimes unexpected and quick as your sacred hair. I accept all of it in the now moment, surrendering to divine will of Goddess. And through all change, I know I am also the eternal witness in beauty. I am at peace in this knowing. I stand in reverence to all of your symbols. I pay attention to all of your signs. Thank you, Mother. All is well, all is well, all is well. Blessed be. Well, good night, listeners. Thanks again for tuning in. And I am going to leave you with a beautiful song by Lane Redman called The Bee Mantra. So enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Have a wonderful week. And remember what Marie Jones told us. I'm sure we know it, but it's always good to be reminded. We create our own reality. We are the creatrix of our life. So in confidence, put out those good intentions. Know that what you ask for, you will receive. Good night, listeners.